Breezy, a fair bit of cloud around, maybe the odd spot of rain, but 14 or so degrees in Aberdeen's not too bad. Then that rain in the north of Scotland slowly slips its way south through Thursday.
Thank you, Jay. The weather from Jay Wynn. And now on Radio 4, our Book of the Week. Colin McFarlane reads another extract from Thomas Brothers' new account of Louis Armstrong's early years in Louis Armstrong, Master of Modernism. In tonight's episode, the young cornet player has arrived in Chicago for the first time.
After Armstrong got settled in his new town, his mentor, Joe Oliver, offered to take him over to the Dreamland Cabaret, one of the largest venues on the south side of Chicago.
Louie, you want to go over and meet Lil?
Who, me? I thought to myself. Lillian Harden with Louis Armstrong. I just couldn't conceive the idea.
Oliver had sent him a photo of Lillian Harden as incitement to come to Chicago from New Orleans.
Tell Miss Lil I like her,
Armstrong wrote back. In 1922, at the age of 24, Harden was just easing out of a bad marriage. So it's possible that Oliver was seriously matchmaking, not just teasing his protege. They were not an obvious couple. Lil was slender, weighed about 85 pounds, and was trained to play classical piano. The great blues singer Alberta Hunter knew them both at the time, and she said Lil might have been spending as much money on clothes as she herself was back then. Quite a statement, given Hunter's extravagant tastes included an $1,800 tailor-made coat and cape. Hunter simply described Louis as a big, overgrown kid. The initial meeting between future husband and wife left Lil unmoved. She didn't like the second-hand, ill-fitting clothes he was wearing, and his hair was combed in an unfashionable fringe that stuck out. I was very disgusted, she recalled. Louis responded with understandable shyness, given the dramatic differences between her and his previous romantic partners. One was a prostitute called Nutsy, who he used to pimp for as a 15-year-old kid back in New Orleans.
Nutsy wasn't very much to look at, but she made good money, he explained.
That relationship soured when Nutsy stabbed him in the shoulder. When Louis's mother found out, she tracked the woman down and nearly choked her to death. He married a prostitute named Daisy Parker a few years later, and their relationship was also marked by violence. Daisy pushed him to the edge when she cut up his Stetson hat with a razor, and she eventually discovered a real point of vulnerability. If she attacked his mouth with a blade, she could jeopardize his musical career. After that, a job that required extended time floating up and down the Mississippi River started to look pretty good to young Louis. There was one time in New Orleans when he had a crush on a light-skinned girl, but he was afraid to talk to her. Felt he wasn't good enough. How much more reluctant he must have been to approach this fancy-dressed pianist from legendary Fisk University. In spite of her small size, Louis thought of Lillian as a big, high-powered chick. Some of the other musicians were making a play for her, but it took a while before that thought occurred to him.
I just couldn't conceive the idea.
After their first meeting, he didn't see her again until she joined Oliver's band in November 1922. She was there to keep the beat and read sheet music. Her engagement with the Southern vernacular music was minimal. Back in Memphis, her training had been classical. A cousin sitting on the front porch once played the rag "St. Louis Tickle" on his guitar, but her grandmother wouldn't let her near him.
That's vulgar music. Get away!
When she sat down to rehearse at her first job in Chicago, she asked what key the piece would be in. And the amused response assured her that the question was irrelevant. It didn't take her long to find her way. She chorded on the beat with no variation whatsoever. 4 beats per measure, which helped hold the texture together. The improvising New Orleanians failed to excite her. From a musical standpoint, jazz didn't mean too much to me, she later admitted. The terms of expression were so different from the music she knew that she had no context for appreciating the quality. She ignored Armstrong's cornet work, which was, after all, in second place to Oliver's. But she perked up one day when Oliver, in a quiet aside, told her that Louis was a better player than he was. Then came the reckless follow-up.
But as long as I keep him with me, he won't be able to get ahead of me.
Lil began to notice the pudgy second cornetist. The two grew closer on the spring 1923 tour. He was now more than simply another one of the homeboys. He was still a bit of a bumpkin, though. One night, he came to work with a new fragrance on, something a friend from his rooming house had given him. Bud Red, the manager at Lincoln Gardens, noticed the cheap scent right away and gave him a hard time. As it turned out, the Bordeaux worked at the stockyards and the perfume was made from fertilizer.
"Well, that ended the smelling session," Louis said.
In spite of their differences, Lil and Louis started to have long conversations during downtime at the club. This led to nighttime wanderings on the Stroll, a long stretch of State Street, the main thoroughfare on the south side. Black musicians never even thought about going downtown.
"We had too much in our own neighborhood," said jazz pianist Earl Hines, recently arrived from Pittsburgh.
Inevitably, the Stroll would be the main scene for the courtship of these two young musicians, with Lil leading the way, since according to Louis,
she knew Chicago like a bug.
The couple started dropping by after-hours spots, after their 1 a.m. finish at Lincoln Gardens, like the Fiume Italian Cafe on South State Street. This place sometimes featured a combination that astonished Louis. White musicians playing for black patrons.
"I'd just come up from the South where there weren't anything as near beautiful as that happening," he said. "White musicians making those colored people swing like mad."
Then came the turning point. One night, Louis looked up to see his mother, May Ann Albert, advancing through the crowd toward the bandstand. He had no idea why she was there.
"How's my boy?" she asked anxiously.
He stared at her, mouth open, and the show was delayed for 20 minutes while she greeted him with obvious relief. Someone back home had mischievously told her that Louis was out of work up north, hungry and sick. She panicked and took off on a rescue mission. But it was clear Louis was thriving, so she started talking about returning home the next day. She was nervous about all the newfangled gadgets of the modern city. Louis wanted her to stay a while, and he enlisted Lil to persuade her. They found her an apartment.
"Now is my turn to prove how thankful I was for the sacrifices she made for me as a boy," he wrote.
As the woman talked that day, looking round the new apartment, Louis slipped into what he called a trance, thinking about how far he'd come since New Orleans, how Nutsy had stabbed him in the shoulder with her chib, and how Mayanne had so fiercely defended him. He realized the distance between New Orleans and Chicago could be measured by the contrast between his mother and Lillian. The Great Migration had made it possible for a low-class hustler from New Orleans to mingle with a savvy, university-educated pianist. It had brought them together in a city lit up by electric lights, where wealth and celebrity were flaunted. With dollar bills spinning through the air, it was a new world in the making, and anything was possible. Having arranged for his protege to meet Lillian, Oliver continued to shape his thinking, musical and otherwise, and Armstrong was always appreciative.
"It was real kicks, listening to music, digging his thoughts. His conception of things, live, music, people in general, was really wonderful. All Joe Oliver had to do was just talk to me, and I'd feel like I'd had one of those good old music lessons of his."
Armstrong was brought to Chicago to bolster his mentor's failing chops, and that is precisely what he did. His role was to support and stay under the lead, and as someone trained to be deferential to older people, especially older musicians, Armstrong understood this well. When we strained to hear him on the recordings of this time, were right where he was in 1923, under the protective arm of his mentor, and doing whatever he could to boost Oliver's success.
I felt that any glory that should come to me must go to him. I wanted him to have all the praise, Armstrong wrote. I was so wrapped up in him that I could take second to his lead in a split second.
With two cornets in close synchrony, they sounded like one voice, a voice that the public identified as Oliver's. The crowds would go mad. Meanwhile, through improvising and harmonizing with his mentor, Louis Armstrong was finding his own voice. Anthropologist Zora Neale Hurston described the high-value African Americans put on ornamentation in this period. She described a cabin in Alabama where the walls were enriched by calendars, scarves, colorful ads from the Sunday paper, crepe paper festoons, and a lithograph of the Treaty of Versailles. Decorating a decoration did not seem out of place to the hostess, she observed. There can never be enough of beauty, let alone too much. Armstrong was surrounded by this attitude. Later in his life, as an old man, he enjoyed making detailed collage decorations on the little boxes that stored his collection of reel-to-reel tapes. His will to adorn comes through again in his prose writings, where he spins out wild displays of hyperpunctuation, capitalization, and underlining. But it was in music, of course, that this decorating passion shaped him most profoundly. However, creative improvisation didn't always wash with Oliver. He had an authoritarian streak and would fire musicians if they didn't do things his way. He started speaking of my band rather than our band. In recording sessions, he picked the pieces to be recorded and decided how to adapt them.
He started being a writer in the studio, said Armstrong.
But Armstrong still found ways to express himself while staying under as the second cornet. And when he wasn't feeling well, Oliver gave Louis some featured solos. These were token gestures. In general, the older man was still holding his apprentice back. Mostly, he kept them both working on those famous cornet duets, so Armstrong couldn't outshine him. In early August 1923, Lil and Louis decided to get married. She started to take a more active role in his life. He mentioned that Oliver had been keeping his money for him, dishing it out periodically as an allowance.
You know, Mr. Joe sent for me and he looks out for me, he explained.
Lil objected, saying she'd be looking out for him from now on. When he showed up for work in a new gray overcoat and velour hat, the club manager cut him down to size, saying,
if you fool around with that chick, she's gonna change your appearance.
Oliver angrily told him that Lillian was spoiled and would waste all his money on clothes and ice cream. But Louis was switching to fashionable dress as a way of signaling his new alignment with Lil, which meant taking a step away from his hometown friends. She also encouraged him to extend his range, take music lessons, learning to transpose music from piano to cornet, and got him listening to classical trumpet music. The two of them composed a new piece together, Tears, which made it into the band's next recording session. And, with his first solo on record, Armstrong showed the record-buying public what he could do.
Colin McFarlane was reading from Louis Armstrong, Master of Modernism by Thomas Brothers. The book is abridged by Eileen Horn, produced by Clive Brill, and is a Pacificus production for BBC Radio 4. And now the shipping forecast, issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Wednesday, the 9th of April, 2014. There are warnings of gales in Trafalgar. The general synopsis at 1800, high Biscay, 1029, expected Plymouth, 1026, by 1800 Wednesday. New low expected Trafalgar, 1012, by the same time. New low moving right.